The mules are in the corral. Welcome to Mule Talk, and I'm Cindy K. Roberts, your host.
And of course, our author, TV personality, and world-renowned mule trainer, Meredith Hodges of the Lucky Three Ranch. We are back in the studio. Meredith, I did bring my cooler, and I've packed it with Diet Cola, so I wasn't sure how long we were going to be talking, but I'm prepared.
Well, that sounds really good, but I'm going to tell you one time here. Don't even drink too much Diet Cola.
Oh.
It'll sneak up on you.
Uh-oh.
You know, water is a much better choice, and I told that to little Jack Horner when he got hooked on Pepsi and iced tea cans.
That's right. Okay. Point well taken.
It does do strange things with him. After a couple, it made him burp, so I thought it was might not be a really good thing to be doing to him. But
okay.
So we have to be careful, Cindy, but I'm glad you're prepared, and we do have a lot of fun talking about all this stuff, and there is just an endless amount, because learning is an ongoing process, and you never, ever stop learning when you open your heart and your mind to it. And all you can do is just keep learning more. And I want to thank you. When we were talking about the subject for this week, I've written 195 mule crossing articles about everything that I've encountered in my training,
right,
and my time with mules. I can't think of everything. And you said you were curious about the trends in training.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought that was an excellent direction to go with all of this, because people are really confused with all the different information that's out there. And so trying to identify some of these trends that have gone on in equine training might be a really good way to go, because we've got a lot of people that have held on to the old ways, a lot of people that are going forward and think they've gone forward as far as they can. But then you and I know that we are always adjusting, altering, modifying all different kinds of training approaches and trying to integrate them. It used to be they were only English or Western or dressage or this, you know. And then we've got that added thing about trying to get mules into the mix. Mules are definitely different to train than horses. People ask me all the time, what's the difference between training a mule and training a horse? And I think you can really narrow it down to just the personality types. Mules are primarily alpha personalities and take exception to being forced to do anything. And that comes from the donkey.
Mm.
Horses, on the other hand, are an introverted personality, and they are easily manipulated and easily forced to do things. They don't have the strength for the resistance like the mule does. A mule can give you quite a battle if he decides he doesn't want to do something.
Oh, yeah.
So you have to think twice getting into your approach and determining how you're going to approach this mule to do what you want him to do. They used to just say, oh, well, you got to be smarter than the mule and you got to make him think it's his idea. Quite frankly, I think it's the other way around. I think we can think that we're making him think it's our idea, but I really think they're making it impossible for it to be anything but their idea.
Oh, yeah.
So we just have to learn to kind of give in to a little bit of this and get a little creative ourselves on accepting new ways to do things. And if you look at history, mules typically, when you think about them, you look at the pictures and all that of mules in history, they're usually in the background, and there are a lot of people on pretty horses in the foreground. Mules, for instance, when they were exploring the United States, which was a vast country to explore, there were people who did ride mules. And one of them that I recognized in a story that I read, there are so many good mule and donkey stories to be had when you start digging into these things. But General Custer thought he was so cool when he was riding across the country on this great big thoroughbred. And he took a whole day trip with Wild Bill Hickok, who was riding a mule named Mouse.
Ah.
Just a little mini mule kind of thing. And they made it to the fort by the end of the day. And Custer was exhausted. His thoroughbred was exhausted. But Wild Bill had to get back from where they started because he had people to meet and things to do. He turned Mouse right around and made that trip all over again. And that mule went all the way there and all the way back. So that was just an example of how tough our mules are. And I don't mean, like I've talked about, tough skin, but their constitution.
Sure.
And their ability to just keep going. And I think that's what we need to do, is not get discouraged when we're with our mules. And that's why we need to learn from them. And when we look at history, there are a lot of cases of that in history. I know that when they made the movement west, for instance, they knew that pulling those covered wagons across the country was not going to be an easy thing to do. So when you look at that history, what you see is you see some horse teams pulling those wagons. And, of course, they had to go over, they had to transverse the Rocky Mountains and other mountain ranges and ford streams and all of that. And the mules were stronger, and they could do that. But then again, who was riding out on front with the pretty horses, the wagon train master, and all these other people, you know, that were riding along on their horses? And you very rarely see people riding mules and feeling all full of confidence and arrogance and narcissism like these people on these horses. When you got a mule, or, you know, you're in the mules, then you realize the attributes of the mules and why there are so few people riding them. Because they really, really do require that you let go of that ego and become a partner in the relationship. And it's a mutual learning thing. You learn from them the approach you should use, and then they learn from you what it is you want them to do. You see this, too, and when you look at the Civil War, for instance. The government officials and the cavalry, for the most part, rode horses. A few guys rode mules. Those were those few individuals that really got along with them.
Right,
But that's not where the old sayings came from. The old sayings came from the guys that were mounted on horses. And they just thought a mule was way too much trouble.
Right.
You know, they embarrassed them, so they didn't want to be caught in the embarrassment. You have to be a confident person in yourself to be able to just say, well, let me see what the attributes of this animal really are. Go ahead and take the chance and ride a mule. And if you remember, at the end of the Civil War, they thought they were being so generous, but I know those people weren't being generous when they decided, when the slaves were free, to give the freed slaves 40 acres and a mule.
Right.
No skin off their teeth.
Right.
Yep. People, an inferior animal, little did they know they were giving them the really superior animal, as we have learned over time, you
right.
know. So these mules were primarily used in history for packing and all of that, and the horses were revered. Actually, horsemanship, as it were, on the upper levels, and what developed our techniques and our way of approaching horse training. The father of horse training was Xenophon, and he was born in 430 BC in Demaergia of Athens. Xenophon's father, Gryllus, was a member of a wealthy equestrian family, and he worked on many of the principles of classical dressage. And Xenophon emphasized training the horse through kindness and reward. And those are the beginnings of dressage. These principles made their way to the Spanish Riding School in Vienna, Austria, where Colonel Podolsky rode for General Patton in World War II. And this style of riding, dressage, called dressage, it's a French word for training, made its way to the West and was transformed into Western dressage, which they do now. That's a more modern approach to dressage. I think it kind of turned into Western dressage because a lot of people didn't want to ride on a postage stamp because our Western macho men are not quite like that. But they did like, you know, the principles of dressage and the step-by-step training, because the object of dressage is the harmonious development of the physique and the ability of the horse. As a result, it makes the horse calm, supple, loose, and flexible, but also confident, attentive, and keen, thus achieving perfect understanding with his rider. That's a quote from the United States Equestrian Federation rulebook. In dressage, one's not concerned with time in training. Rather, it's measured in progress from one step to the other. And dressage requires a discipline of your mind and your body. And this slow and methodical way of training lends itself nicely to mules, because mules don't like to be in a hurry. And most of this forceful training came from people being in a hurry to use these mules and horses for whatever activities they wanted to use them for. Mules will separate the crude trainers from the artistic trainers in this way, because they refuse to be forced. And a mule handled by a crude trainer will generally epitomize the traditional belief that mules are stubborn and ornery. The mule handled by an artistic trainer will not. The difference is basically patience and kindness. The Indians of old in the West did train their animals in a step-by-step process that was kind of a takeoff from dressage. They didn't learn it from the Europeans, but they did learn how to get along with nature and to get along with the animals in nature and only take what they had to for survival. And this meant going ahead and hunting those bison herds of thousands to feed their tribes. The only way that they were going to be able to pace themselves with those herds is to be on a four-legged creature like a horse and keep up with them. They had bows and arrows. They did not have guns until the white men came. They had to be very creative in the way that they trained their animals. And they didn't necessarily train mules back then, and I think it was probably for the same reasons. First of all, they just weren't that numerous, if at all, because wild horses didn't naturally allow themselves to be bred by wild donkeys. They kept pretty much separate that way. So the Indians' training methods was primarily done with horses, and they would use more of an imprinting approach, in that they got the horses used to being touched all over, and they would hoist their bodies up on their backs. And if they used anything at all for their seat to make it more comfortable, it's not too comfortable to ride on an equine spine, and especially for a guy, I would think. But anyway,
yeah.
So they used, you know, hides. They'd put them on and strap them down with leather straps that they made or rope that they've woven. And then the other thing is in order to follow these herds, they had to have some kind of control over these horses. So they would generally just take a strap and put it around the lower jaw. And so they had one rein going back to themselves, and they could kind of steer the horses this way or that way. The other thing that they needed to do when they were imprinting these horses was to get them used to them being anywhere on the horse without getting kicked and without getting dumped. So they made these horses used to them sliding off to the side and hanging off the side so they could sneak up on the bison and come up with their and they had that, the bows and arrows with them, so the horses had to become used to those things too. And granted, you know, we're talking a lot about different personalities in these animals. And no doubt there were horses that were going to be more difficult to ride and steer But those are the ones with real energy. I always like the mules that have a lot of energy and have a lot of fight to them. Because if you can figure out how to communicate with them, they're the ones that are going to give you that little bit of extra. They're going to have that little bit of extra to put more effort into it. They're going to be stronger. They're going to be more flexible. They're going to be faster. They're going to stop quicker.
Yeah.
They're going to spin on a dime, and they are going to be the ones that you really want for some kind of an activity.
Right.
Like going and getting your supper.
You know? There you go.
So the Indians had to have a way to get some kind of control of these kinds of horses, and they developed a war bridle, which is that loop that simulates a bit going into their mouth and under their chin. But they took an extra loop through that loop and brought that loop up over their head and rested on the pole behind their ears, which gave them a bridle and a little bit more leverage on the head of the horse. If anybody tried that on a mule, they would soon find that it wouldn't make any difference. If they wanted to run off with you and they did not want to follow the herd of bison, they wouldn't, you know. But
right.
But horses, on the other hand, are weaker in the neck and their back than mules. They can kind of be manhandled a little bit, if you will, and be encouraged to do what you want, and they will comply. The Indians actually were a lot smarter than the cowboys were at that point in time, because the cowboys were so busy being macho men that they felt they had to conquer the horse, this wild beast on the prairie. And there were wild horses all over that they could catch. And because they were not as strong as mules and donkeys, they could be forced into submission. And these cowboys, they used all kinds of techniques, like blindfolds for mounting and forceful restraint, would lie the animal down and put blankets over them to impress the animal with their dominance. And horses would generally give in. And then the cowboys, too, they used a lot of these same techniques to get the saddle on in the beginning. And it was called breaking horses and mules. And if they could get the saddle on, then they would have several guys hold the animal, and then the cowboy that was going to ride them got on, and they just bucked them out until they quit bucking. And these kinds of approaches were not really readily acceptable after a while with modern, more discreet and polite society. People began getting very insulted by these inhumane, as they call them, techniques. The cowboys had to hide those kinds of techniques behind society's vision. And so these trainers may use those kinds of things, but they weren't about to let us know it. They had to monitor and manipulate these techniques so what they put out in the public didn't seem to be as rough as the history that they really had. They just wouldn't let us see these things. And when we wanted our animals trained by other people, these horse trainers said, well, I'll be glad to train your horse for this amount of money. And then, of course, money became the god of society and the driving force in society instead of real God. I mean, you can get a long way by praying, you know.
Sure.
And mules like it, too, because you took the time to pray.
Right.
You know, and you just didn't launch into them, you know, abusively as they saw it. And mules don't like being used and abused anyway. They like to be a partner in the game. These cowboys that came through history, like Buck Brannaman, John Lyons, Pat Pirelli, Clint Anderson, they all came around with this approach in the round pen, and they did quite well with this approach where the animal is confined, and the animal would get chased around the round pen and eventually give up, and then the cowboy would go to the middle of the round pen, and they would wait till the animal came to them or the animal was quiet, and then they would do their thing. And back then, when those guys were really popular, I thought, oh, okay, I see what they're doing. They're just making the animals tired. Because here's these animals, after being run around a round pen for a long time, they're breathing really hard. It made sense to me, watching them, that if they made the animal tired, then they wouldn't put as much effort into bucking and everything else when I got on. However, when I got on, they still bucked.
Uh-oh.
And I was like, oh, well, maybe I just need to run them around more, you know. And then they went into desensitizing. Oh, my God, this trainer for my mom introduced me to desensitization.
Yeah.
And he used to put the mules, the older mules, 3-, 4-, 5-year-old mules in a stall and tie them in the corner and then just be really obnoxious with a tarp and just kept whacking them with the tarp until they stood still. And I thought, oh, that looks like a good idea. My Arabian horse has been bucking me off a lot. Maybe I'll do that. So I went ahead and sacked her out with the tarp. All she did was get more nervous. Then when I let her loose and went to try to ride her, she didn't think I was bigger and stronger or anything than her. But she still bucked me off.
Uh-oh.
So then I ran into this thing where they thought that tying them to a tire would be a really good idea. And then I learned about hobbles and hobbling and all that stuff. So I took my mare out in the middle of the arena. She was an Arabian. Arabians being typically smart and intelligent like mules are, than your run-of-the-mill quarter horses. She didn't give up. I tied her to this tire. I hobbled her front feet. I sacked her out with the tire, and she still bucked. She bucked me off every single trail ride we went on.
Ooh.
But only once at the beginning when I mounted up. She was just trying to let me know, oh, you think you're getting one over on me? I don't think so. You know, you are really dense and you take a long time to learn. You know? But finally, I got it. I didn't see that guy sacking those mules out in the corner of a stall was really gaining very much respect from the mules. They really didn't like him. He said he didn't want to work with the youngsters anymore because they gave him too much trouble. My mom put me in charge of the 30 mules a year that we produced, and I did all the halter training and all the leading training. And when I did, I learned that if you go slowly, that they're actually kind of fun to play with. And I was learning approaches with them that would yield all kinds of things. I also noticed that at the same time that I was modifying my methods, that so were the horse trainers. The ones that seemed to modify it, Pat Pirelli, he used the freedom of movement, the natural horsemanship, let the animal pretty much do their own thing. And he used to ride a lot of them bridleless, and he would just use these parrot sticks, as he calls them, to turn them. And he would sit down in the saddle to make them stop. And that was pretty cool, I thought. And the animal seemed to be really happy with that. Thought, oh, we're making good strides here. It's not the rough and rowdy kind of training that I had seen with previous horse trainers. And I found that a lot of the mules could tolerate it, but it didn't always yield the most positive results. Natural horsemanship was an attractive trend. We're talking about trends. But animals, equines included, there is no living creature that is born in their ideal posture any more than humans are. Natural horsemanship fails to put the equine into an ideal equine posture. And I noticed that as they aged, the equines were still getting lordosis, which is being sway-backed. And then a new thing came to light called kissing spine. And this also occurs as the animal ages. Kissing spine is caused by the spinous processes that are above the vertebrae in the back. They're being scrunched together because the animal is raising their head, hollowing their neck, and hollowing their back. And then we put weight on that. And where the rubbing is occurring is starting to calcify. It can be, in some cases, broken loose. I do have a skeleton here, and I consulted with my veterinarian about it, and we were looking at the skeleton, and in one place on the skeleton of this draft mule, there was a place that started to calcify, but it had broken loose. There were vertebrae behind that one, several of these spinous processes that were really calcified together, and no way were they going to break loose. And I asked him, I said, so how do they treat this kissing spine, as they call it? And he says, well, they have a rather radical surgery that they do, and they get in there with a saw, and they saw between these spinous processes. He says, but you see that one that broke loose there? He says, I bet that one was one that broke loose when you put this mule into your elbow pull, and he was asked to go ahead and stretch his spine through all the movements and all the training that you did with him, which was primarily with him, it was the primary training, and the only training he could handle was putting that elbow pull on and leading him through the hourglass pattern with all the different tasks that happen in that hourglass pattern. And with his buddy, Roll, put him in good posture, and I was actually able to go forward with his teammate for 9 more years after I had to put Rock down because of the shattered hip. But Roll had ring bone and side bones in 3 feet, but doing those postural exercises really helped him. And I noticed that there were two trainers that stuck out in my mind that took this step-by-step approach and did not force anything. They were the true resistance-free trainers, and that was Monty Roberts and Richard Schrake.
Yeah.
Monty Roberts sat out there on the prairie and waited for the wild horses to come to him. And then when Monty Roberts did take the animals and put them in a formal training thing in the round pen, he did not just chase them around aggressively. He kind of walked through it and sent them forward in the round pen, and I was watching very carefully. And then when he went to the middle, he turned his back on them and didn't even look at them. And that's how he developed joining up. No longer was he a threat to them by facing them. And the other trainers picked up on what Monty was doing. And so they adopted his way, and they were more successful with the animals joining up with them too. And Richard Schrake, he spent more time on groundwork and was able to start building bodies because he was concerned with the way that they were feeding these animals in the AQHA, so that your yearlings no longer look like yearlings, they look like mini adults, because they had so much bulk muscle on them that they were no longer built downhill in a yearling class and allowed to develop in their own natural way. So Richard just did the showmanship training and took it step by step by step and allowed these animals to come along in their own time with these overdone bodies. It's like putting them on steroids, which was unhealthy for them, but this is the way the shows went. This was how to win a class. This was how to win the money. And the focus was not on getting the animals and the people together. It was not on really developing your animal in a more natural way from the core. And the core being those elements that support the animal's skeleton. When we saddled these two-year-olds and three-year-olds and raced these two-year-olds and three-year-olds, we weren't concerned with the fact that before their joints are hard bones, they're cartilage. They're born with cartilage on the ends of their feet before their hooves are developed. I mean, that only takes a couple days, and you can see it, because those long little fingers that are on their hooves in the beginning will drop off. So we can see that. But we don't see how soft those joints are all the way through until their bodies are really matured. And they really aren't matured all that much until, what, 4, 5, even 6 years old. And that is when you're looking at individual development again. You can't just say, generally speaking, that all animals are going to be fully fused in their joints by 3 years old, although that's what they were, you know, saying. That's what they told me. So, yeah, you can get on and ride at three because they're ready for that. Well, no, they're not. They're really, really not. What really grinds me is that now the trend of the day is to lay your animal down so you can mount easier. I don't have any trouble with people laying animals down. They've been training them to bow and do all kinds of tricks that are strenuous on their bodies for centuries. Circuses have been doing it forever. But see, when you see an animal that is doing an extraordinary job on his tricks, chances are that trainer has taken the time with that animal to develop his body slowly, so he's not being hurt by learning how to do those tricks. The trainer that forces those tricks are the ones that are really going to injure the animal's body in the long run. And I saw a great example of it at the World Equestrian Game, where this guy was doing an exhibition and he was showing people how he trained this mare to bow, and he did it with ropes. And he basically had two ropes, one on the front foot and a rope on the halter that he draped around the offside and brought over the saddle horn so that he could pull up on the front leg that was closest to him and take it off the ground, and then pull her over by turning her head sideways with the other rope. And then he would hold her like that. Well, he did that, and it took 15 minutes. And then this lady came over, and he goes, and that's the way we teach them to bow. And I was thinking, well, that animal doesn't have very much muscle strength in her body at all. That's pretty obvious. She's been down for 15 minutes now, and she's shaken all over. And then, of course, he let her up, and then she was still shaken, but she came out of it. And then the host of the exhibitions there in the exhibition hall came by and said, oh, well, you're not done yet. And he said, well, I thought I just had to do this exhibition. She says, I gave you a whole hour. You've got 45 more minutes. And that guy took that mare up and down and up and down for another 45 minutes, and it just made me sick.
Oh, wow.
But it did, like it always does, prompt me to be the anal and stubborn person that I am, that I've learned from mules. And I thought, well, I'm going to investigate this because I want to know how long it would take a mule to learn to bow of his own volition without me forcing him to do anything. Lance and I, Sir Lancelot, my totally dedicated mule that ran off when I tried to teach him to side pass with a crop.
Wow.
He doesn't take forcing on anything. You know, I bet to get him to side pass along a fence with a riding crop, and he's, oh, no, you're not doing that. And he took off with me across the arena until I dropped it. And then he went back to the fence and he side passed. I was like, okay. So I thought, he's the one I need to ask for all of this. So I took him into the arena and I asked him to give me a front foot. Well, he didn't want to pick up his front foot in the middle of the arena. So I thought, well, how about if I give you some of these oats out of the fanny pack if you give me your foot? He goes, oh, okay, I'll do that. Here, take my foot. So he did, and the hard part was getting him to stand still for a long period of time while I held his foot. I had to hold the foot with the right hand and shovel the oats with the left hand for about, well, probably only about 5 minutes to start. But every time we went out there, we did it longer so that he got used to standing on three legs while I held this other foot. And he got a whole bundle of oats. He loved that. He thought that was a great way to train. So then I switched hands, and I held his foot in the left hand after a while. After he could stand on it for about 15 minutes, he got to where he could stand on it for 15 minutes. And then I had him give it to me, and I held it in the left hand. And then I grabbed the oats in the right hand, and he's going, "Give me my oats." And he's draping his head around the outside of his body. And I go, "Oh, no, no, we're going to do this a little differently this time. I'm going to put my hand between your legs, and you're going to stick your nose down there and arch your back." So he did, but he was kind of stiff, so he really couldn't bring his nose between his legs too very far. So the next steps we did were just trying to get him to bring that nose down farther and farther and farther with each lesson until he put his knee to the ground. And then, of course, he got a lot of oats doing that, too. And he loved it. He thought it was great. It took him 18 months before he could just do it. I didn't have to hold his foot anymore. I just pointed at his leg, and he bent it like he was going to give it to me. And then I just put my hand down between his legs and asked him to bow down, and he did. And pretty soon, I could get him to where I just pointed down between his legs, and he would go ahead and bow because he could.
Right.
And one time, he got so enthused about the bowing that I was standing there with my pointing between his legs, and he's going down, and he put his knee to the ground, and then he decided he was going to lay down.
All right.
And I said, "No, no, 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 that's not what I asked for." And I poked him in the shoulder, and then he stood back up. But he would have come over. He would have come over. And all I did was just reward him for each step that we tried to do. So I know that I could have taken him all the way to the ground, but I couldn't see a reason to do it. So I didn't. He was almost on top of me anyway. He almost was on the ground. And when he did that, it was in the stall. So luckily the wall was behind me because he knocked me off balance. And I had to lean up against the wall to poke him in the shoulder to make him get back up, or he probably would have squashed me. But he didn't. He moved back away from my finger and did what he was supposed to. So that was totally cool. But I got really incensed about people that were taking animals that really didn't have the core strength to go up and down with their own bodies, much less with a rider on board and adding weight to that. And I thought about what that must do to the joints, the musculature it's taking to get them up and down like that. It just didn't seem like the right thing to do to me. And then I saw animals that I had seen previously, you know, years before, that did those kinds of things. And now these people are injecting their joints because their joints are sore. Their bodies are sore. They've got arthritis popping up all over the place. I thought to myself, self, this isn't a good way for mounting. And I got to thinking that maybe a mounting block would be better. And then they would tell me, "Oh, well, you can't take a mounting block on the trail."
No, but.
No, you're right. You can't.
But.
So how about getting a shorter mule for trail?
What I did one time was I was out in the woods and I trained Cabo. I trained her to
straddle
a log where the log was.
And stop in the middle.
Yeah, stop in the middle.
Very ingenious.
And that's all it took.
See how many creative ideas we can come up with?
Yeah.
That do not involve being lazy.
That's right.
And you got to remember, too, that these equines are built to carry weight underneath the spine and not on top, making them carry more weight on their back and then getting up and down to do that. And the other thing that I did with my mules, too, is I taught them how to stretch out like a park horse.
Yeah.
So that lowers their back, lowers the access to the stirrup, and it makes it easy to get on that way. And here's the other thing, too. They do make stirrups that you can go ahead and drop that are easily accessed from underneath the fender on a Western saddle, or even easier on an English saddle if you ride in English, that you can lengthen it to get on and then adjust it once you're up there. That doesn't really infringe on the animal's overall health when you use some of these creative ways to do this. My mules could really lower their back, and they showed me that it's much easier for them to then just step forward with the hindquarters. Then once they've got the hindquarters underneath, they just step back with the front feet a couple less steps, and they're back standing right up.
Yeah.
And they haven't really hurt themselves when they did that. Actually, nothing works better than behavior modification and a reward system for training to get them to step over a log and stop. When they get rewarded by things, then they're more inclined to do what you want them to do. And this behavior modification, but when I first started talking about it, they took it to mean just reward training. And then with the horse trainers teaching them all the different things they could teach their animals to do that were really just tricks. They have them sidle over to a fence next to you is a trick. It's not paying any kind of attention to their body development to have them do these things for you. I admire the trainers, I might say at this point, that do take the time to go ahead and build the bodies concurrently with their trick training. I know a really good trainer, Lori Wilson, and her mule, Toby Jack. She does this.
Right.
She trains dressage, but she also trains Toby Jack to do all kinds of really cool things, trick-wise, and it's just a complete pleasure to watch them work together. The other thing that I learned about trick training, which is just another trend, is that I watched a mule that clicker trained his owner at the wash rack. It was okay. Hilarious. She wanted to take him in for a bath, but he didn't want to walk on the concrete that was wet. So she had her clicker with her, and she went ahead, and when he took a step forward, she clicked, and then she gave him a food reward. So he learned that if he could make her click, that he would get a reward. So instead of just walking into the wash rack, he only walked into the wash rack one step at a time to make her click. She emptied her whole fanny pack, clicking his way into the wash rack, which was hilarious. People like to say that, yeah, you're getting somewhere. I don't think that when you leave out the verbal communication that it's going to work all that well in the long run.
Right, right.
They like to talk to you. And even a mule that's with you and you're walking up to him or something and getting ready to do something with him, if you listen carefully, they will kind of talk to you that way.
Yeah.
And they really enjoy their verbal communication with you. And a clicker just ate all that.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So I think you get a lot farther just making that extra effort. But see, that effort is a learning curve for you, because then you need to respond appropriately to their body language with your appropriate body language. And have you ever seen a clicker built into a human being?
Interesting.
Isn't it? Interesting concept, anyway.
Yeah.
But my brain kind of goes sideways like that every once in a while. But it does get me to what the mules are trying to teach me here. I also want to mention at this point, too, that it is so important to pay attention to how your animal's being developed. I'm not saying don't do the fun things, because I think you should. The animals, when you pay attention to the stress on their body and what they have to do in order to perform these things that we're asking them to do, as long as they're performed really close to good posture, and as long as you have taken the time to develop their core elements, then they're going to have a solid base to work from, and it won't hurt them. Towing tires in the snow are really fun. Running along the side of a lake with a person next to you on water skis might be fun, but consider the amount of resistance of the weight of the water skier against the animal's good posture during these two activities. When you're towing tires behind you, the animal can sustain its own good posture. But when you're towing somebody from the side, whether it be a tire in the snow or a water skiing on a lake or something like that, it can be very stressful on the animal's good posture and actually cause glitches in their body. It will cause soreness. Now, when I wanted to be towed by my mule, I had to stretch a sidewalk in front of my, you know, house, and that was the only stretch of concrete I had on the whole place. But I was learning to do rollerblades, but I wasn't keen enough on rollerblades to go to the rollerblade park and make a fool out of myself by falling down all over the place.
No.
So I thought my mule could teach me how to do that on the sidewalk. And so I had taught her to lead backwards by her tail, as well as going forward from the drive lines and all that during the ground driving stage. And I thought, well, she could learn to pull me with her tail. Well, we got on the sidewalk. She did everything through verbal command, so I didn't have to have anybody lead her. It was just her and me. And I grabbed her tail, and she started to back up. Like, no, this isn't the way I want to go. This is what you learned, but we're not doing it this way this time. And she stopped, and she turned around and looked at me and go, make up your mind. And so I tapped her on her rump, held on to her tail, and said, walk on. And she dragged me the full length of the sidewalk while I was on my rollerblades.
Wow.
And it worked really well, and it was a whole lot of fun. The thing is, I think with all of this, you just need to learn to think about the consequences of your actions in the relationship and the effect it has on your equine's body, and then prepare yourself accordingly when you're asking them to do these things. Now, there was no way that I was going to remember that I taught her to go backwards when I grabbed her tail. She had to remind me. We had taken so many small steps before. I knew what an immediate fix was going to be to stop her from making me push up against her butt and then have to go backwards on my rollerblades and maybe fall down.
Right.
You know? So that, you know, when you think about these kinds of things and you break them down into little tiny steps like that, you give yourself time to recover quickly before you get hurt. A lot of people use restraints, too, when they're training their animals, and have the mindset that they're going to be dealing with an outlaw. But it's my experience that even when an animal is an outlaw to speak of, it's only because they've been forced to go through training too fast. And then what happens if the animal messes up, then we have a tendency to blame them and get mad. So it's really important that you take on the right attitude towards training. And if they make a mistake, don't get mad. Just rethink the whole situation and break it down into even smaller steps so that they can succeed. Some will tell you that they need to be rehabilitated. You just need to be kind. But you'll need to know what you're doing if you're going to rehabilitate an animal, because just being kind is not enough. That's just enough to spoil them.
Right.
And then they, you know, they pick up all these other habits that can be a problem. I'm not saying don't have fun with them. And I'm not saying that you can't do tricks and that you can't do these extraordinary things. Just be aware when you're doing them and be willing to not jump to anger so quickly, and be willing to look at yourself and say, okay, I need to get a little bit more creative here and break this down into smaller steps so I can help them to succeed. Long ears themselves do not seek to impress, nor do they have inflated ideas of importance like we humans do. They're humble, not greedy or selfish, and are content to give freely all that they have to give. There is no limit to their endurance, no end to their trust. Unpleasant moments are undoubtedly remembered, yet forgiven when requested. You have to ask them for forgiveness if you've messed up. Owners should be inspired to be more constructive in their management and training approach. Within long ears, there's a hidden hope of happiness, contentment, peace, and brotherhood. The inspiration of these noble characteristics does not go unnoticed as they ennoble everyone around them. Mules and donkeys are very appreciative animals, and they're very good with children because of these characteristics. Children are basically very, very naive about what they do. Whatever they do, they're honest about it, like animals are. And the animals sense this in children, and that's why mules and donkeys, who are particularly sensitive to children, are much easier to forget bad experiences that they've had with adults and let go of it and be forgiving with children almost immediately. They're really good babysitters. We can only blame ourselves, and the fears that we have about them being with children are brought on to the way they've reacted to us. So if we haven't been patient with them, it's no wonder they're worried about them not being patient with the kids. But if you recognize that, then you'll realize that you can trust your mule or donkey a lot further than you think you can. But you do have to be honest about yourself to be able to do that. Good mule trainers apply the basic techniques of behavior modification, which is reward system training. And that is just getting the desired responses through positive reinforcements and ignoring as much as possible the undesirable behaviors. If you have to have some negative reinforcement with an animal to set the boundaries, you do it quickly, get in, you get out. With new training techniques, mules of today are known for their beauty and outstanding athletic ability, their durability, their intelligence. Their uses are limited only to the imaginations of their owners. I have proven over the years that these mules can do anything that horses can do, and then some. Don't be afraid to challenge yourself and your mule, but don't get mad. Stop yourself from getting mad. Just keep asking yourself, if this is going wrong, what do I need to do to make it right? Now, there's a place where you're going to see mules doing all kinds of different things that horses used to do, and even more than horses do, like roping steers from a chariot. And that's at Bishop Mule Days.
Yeah.
Up there in the Sierra Nevada Mountains in California. A long time ago, they even had mule racing there, which I thought was awesome, because it was actual paramutual mule racing. And it had its beginnings in the eastern Sierra Nevada Mountains in California in 1851, when Captain Bowling's cavalry troop was forced to halt for 2 months in the Yosemite Valley. Horse racing was one of the major events that they used to keep up the spirits of the men during this unexpected respite. Army mules were included in those races to add to the entertainment. Much to the chagrin of many of the horse owners, the mules could actually beat some of the cavalry's favorite mounts. So Captain Bowling purchased one Maltese Kentucky-blooded mule known as the Fining Mule. He was particularly impressed and bought him for $1,000 in gold from Lee Vining. He then went on to make many more thousands in match races with this mule against horses. To quote from the official racing program, the Indian War of 1851 was the catalyst that started the first running of mules in California. The first actual paramutual mule meet was held in Bishop, California in July of 1978. Match races and Western-style races included at the county fairs exhibit the true versatility of the mule. With increased interest, mule racing now assumes the professionalism of horse training with the introduction of jockeys, trainers, and starting gates. This mule racing may have started in Bishop in 1978, but 1979 was the first year I went to Bishop and actually saw mule racing. It was hilarious. Mules didn't know you were supposed to keep running in a straight line. So these mules did everything in these races. They thought they could. They serpentined. They ran slow. They ran super fast and out of control with their riders. And some of them ran up to the grandstands, turned around, and ran the other way.
All right.
It was hilarious. Bishop Mule Days has grown over the years, and they have kept adding all kinds of classes. And at Bishop Mule Days, you'll see pleasure classes, reining classes, trail, musical tires, barrel racing, pole bending, jumping, cattle penning, steer stopping, team roping, and even a balloon bust, packers, pack train classes, packing classes, box hitch, diamond hitch, pros, non-pros, team packing scramble, which you have to see to believe. They bring in teams with two horses and five mules, and they unpack them all and lay all the gear on the floor and turn all the animals loose, and they're all running around. These packers have to catch them up, pack them, and then run around the racetrack. It's amazing. There's halter classes, pulling classes, driving classes. And for you race fans, chariot races, fast flat track races, and even a backwards race. Wow. Leave it to a mule to race backwards.
Wow.
They will do it. I saw a mule, picture of a mule in a magazine called Merrister Farms Kit that was owned by Edith Conyers. And she went into combined training, and she was the one that inspired me to get my mule into combined training. And it took us 3 years, but we finally got good enough, doing a little at a time and paying attention to the physical development of the animal, to get into those combined training shows, those horse trials, which were often 3 days. They're spread over 3 days. Because what that is dressage, stadium jumping, and cross country. And the first year she got eighth place, the second year she got second place, and the third year she beat them all. And then they thought we were so good, they encouraged us to get into a combined driving show where we were doing driven dressage, a cones course, and then a cross-country course while hitched. And she won the only two shows she did doing that right off the bat. We didn't even have to do much preparing because we'd done it for the under-saddle stuff. And so a lot of counties have been taking the initiative to include mules and donkeys in the county fairs, local riding clubs, all breed shows. They understand now, they better understand and appreciate the positive qualities of long ears and what they bring to these shows, because, you know, people are used to seeing horses show, but when a donkey or a mule comes in, people have a whole different reaction to them. These generous ways of these mules and donkeys has positively influenced people toward a genuine pursuit of happiness. People agree that the best part of their long journeys with their mules was all about the wonderful people that they meet along the way, who did everything that they could to help them reach their destination. People extended their hospitality, allowing them to bed down at their ranches along the route. Others met them at strategic points with feed and water and other necessary supplies that would be difficult to carry with them. Many new friendships have been made along the trail, and that's why you see people like Bernie Harberts and the Mule Man taking these mules down the road to explore our country from one end to another, 3,000 miles, 1,500 miles.
Oh, my.
You know, and the influence of doing things like that and the camaraderie it builds between among people is quite extraordinary, actually.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And I can't say that these mule men necessarily prepared their mules for the journey, but I can say this from meeting them. They sure learned a lot of stuff along the way.
Right.
Right. And we're all going to make mistakes before we learn.
Sure.
So can't really be mad at them because these guys learned a long way. You know, they really did. And they talked about it. Both of them did, the ones I mentioned. And I think it's pretty cool. Pretty cool what mules do for people. Mules are excellent mountain partners. They are a strong and durable animal. And due to the cup shape of their hooves, they can cover those rough mountain terrain with much more sure-footedness than their cousin, the horse. Mules' superior intelligence and their strong sense of survival helps them to negotiate careful placements of their feet, ensuring the safest possible ride. This is both important and comforting when looking for a relaxing ride in the mountains. The mule's strength and endurance is sometimes unbelievable and always incredible. In closing, the trends of equine training have certainly improved by leaps and bounds through the centuries, but we are still plagued by those who are too naive to really access how their behavior influences that of their equine and are subsequently influenced by substandard training practices. It's always best to learn from past mistakes and try to do better going forward. You and I hope that we can share our experiences with all the people in our audience so they too can experience the same kind of joy and pleasure that we do with our equines. I wish our audience and everyone who hears these podcasts happy trails to you all.
I love it.
You do?
I'm speechless. Oh, that was good.
Very cool, Meredith. Well, it's lunchtime.
It is. You have a great rest of the day, Cindy.
Meredith's website is lucky3ranch.com, and you can call her at 1-800-816-7566. And I can be reached through my website, everycowgirlsdream.com. Don't forget, hit the subscribe button.
Gotta go. My mule is looking for me.
Mule Talk is an Every Cowgirl's Dream production.